The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
I'd like to introduce our panellists today. The first one is Daniel Kowalski. Daniel is a former Australian middle and long distance swimmer. At the 1996 Olympic Games in Atlanta, he won two bronze medals in the 200 and 400 metres and silver in the 1500 metres. And at the 2000 Sydney Olympics, he won gold as part of the victorious Australian men's 4x200 metre relay team. He's been actively involved in swimming since his retirement, commentating at the Beijing Games and mentoring, coaching and advising elite athletes. Now he's the general manager of the Australian Swimmers Association, and he's also sung on national TV with Kate Sobrano. You could perhaps ask him more about that. Please, everyone, welcome Daniel Kowalski.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to make him go red.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
That was gold.
Our second panellist today is Cameron Butler. Cam is an ordained Christian minister, and he's a passionate Demons supporter. He's also been the chaplain to the Melbourne Football Club for nearly 14 years. And he's also the National Director of Sports Chaplaincy Australia. Please welcome Cam Butler.
I haven't sung with Kate Sobrano.
I haven't sung with Kate Sobrano. Well, thanks, gentlemen, for agreeing to come here today. The Olympic Games are here, and I must confess, I'm exhausted. I've competed in so many events so far, watching them on the screen. So much sport. Have you enjoyed the games? Have you been enjoying the games? Any highlights?
I love watching the Olympic Games. I love any sport on television. I think for me one of the highlights was an English person saying this week, when we'd only won one gold, was quoted as saying Australia's won as many gold as they have been arrested. But anyway, that was a joke by an English person. But I just love it when we beat the English. So for me, there's been highlights.
Beating the English, yes. About three of them.
Yes, three.
Three. How about you, Dad? You've been enjoying the games?
Yeah, I love it. Yeah. I haven't loved the time difference this time around. I've struggled with that, but you know, outside of the obvious, the swimming, I really enjoyed, you know, yesterday morning to see those Anna Mears and Sally Pearson win so close to one another, and the way they do it, the way they carry themselves in such graciousness and style, I think it really. I get inspired by seeing those feats.
That's great. We can talk a bit more about that.
Can I ask you, I shed a tear when I saw the girl standing up there. It was very emotional for me, and I was holding back the tears. Does that remind you of when you stood up there on the podium?
No, not at all. But having said that, I find myself quite often shedding tears, even if I feel there's no... No, I felt a connection being an Australian watching... the replay of Anna Mears' presentation, and I actually haven't seen the one that Sally Pearson had earlier this morning, but you know, there was a gentleman from the Dominican Republic who won the 400 hurdles, and he was just sobbing uncontrollably, and you know, the background was his grandmother had passed away prior, and I cry then, and I cry when there's excitement and disappointment. I just cry.
Well, very emotional experience, I'm sure. We can talk a little bit more. We can maybe touch on some of those subjects a bit more as we talk about what it means to win and what particularly characterises winning. But so any other highlights as well? So I suppose the time difference worked well, Daniel, for the swimming heats at least. I suppose we could sit there in prime time watching the swimming heats, but the finals were a bit more of a challenge to get up.
I love the Olympics because you can watch sports you wouldn't normally watch. So I wouldn't naturally watch hockey, but I love watching hockey when the Olympics are on. Volleyball, for example. Just some of those sports you just wouldn't get much exposure to. Really, really enjoy.
Like sailing, for example. Australia's apparently now becoming... Sailing's going to become our national sport, I think, isn't it? We're doing very well in the sailing. But I suppose also there's an interesting comment there, because there are some sports which we normally wouldn't get associated with, but we haven't seen any coverage of the fencing or the handball or other sports that we don't really seem to be competitive in. Yeah, would you like to see more fencing, do you think?
If you live in Broadmeadows, there's lots of fencing. To be honest, I love seeing fencing. I love seeing some of those unusual sports. I couldn't for the life of me understand sailing, though. Because you don't know when's the start, when's the finish. Like, I thought they'd started, but they were just lining up, tacking to start. So. That's enough from me, anyway.
I think if you're one of those people fortunate enough to have Foxtel, I think they've been quite... broad with what you've been able to watch.
Right. So you have a Foxtel, do you? Have
your HLs? I do. I claim it as a tax write-off for work. But having, you know, I haven't watched Channel 9, and for a lot, if I have, I've generally muted as well.
Right. That's fair enough. So, now Daniel, well, it's wonderful to have you here, a former Olympian, and congratulations on your athletic performances. You were a competitor at the 96 Atlanta Games and at the 2000 Games in Sydney. Just tell us a little bit, what's it like to be at the Olympic Games, like to be one of the competitors? Just tell us a little bit about it.
Surreal. I was the type of kid who just grew up basically from the age of 9 wanting to go to the Olympic Games. The 84 Olympics were on at that time, and I looked at it for what it was, but not understanding what it was. You know, it was a backdrop of Los Angeles and Hollywood, and whilst I swam, I figured you maybe go to Target, you buy the tracksuit, you buy an airplane ticket, you go over, you line up, you stand behind a block and you swim. I didn't understand the process to get there, but I loved everything associated with it. So to get there was very surreal, and then to be in the village and people who graced your walls, you know, posters on the wall are there, you whip out the autograph book, and still to this day, I never felt as though I belonged there because I felt I was always a fan.
Right.
So to live out, it sounds corny and cliche, but to live out a childhood dream so young, you know, it makes life afterwards quite difficult to put other things in perspective and importance. But it's the beauty of it, regardless what happens, no one can ever take that away from you.
No. So was there anyone's autograph that you're particularly keen to get, or that you got that you were...
Well, I was always a basketball fan, so I just really wanted to get members of the Dream Team their autograph. Mm-hmm. And as you can imagine, there's so many people sworn them to the point where they don't stay in the village, and also because apparently they don't fit on the beds. but Muhammad Ali was in the dining hall one day in 96. Same thing. You generally can't get close to those people because they get swamped. Mm. Even I remember in Sydney 2000, sitting in the dining hall at a table where Ian Thorpe was at, and he was getting swamped, and that was weird. But that's the beauty of the Olympics. Mm. That's what makes.
Were you getting swamped much at all? Were people wanting to kind of clamour?
No, they just pushed you out of the way. Fine by me.
So tell us a bit more about it was like living a dream in many respects. Like Atlanta got a lot of criticism for being a bit disorganised, people missing events and so on because the buses weren't there. Like, was your experience of the Atlanta Games chaotic, or was it?
The beauty of it is that you're in your own little bubble, so you don't realise a lot of these things are happening. And you know, this makes me sound old, but I was around in the time where the World Wide Web was only just sort of becoming accessible to the masses, and there was no, you know, smartphones or any social media. So we were cut off from all that unless you would call home and ask the questions. So I didn't know. Obviously, the bomb that went off, I was in drug testing when that happened, so I was fine. But generally, you just went about and, you know, it was very Charlie and the Chocolate Factory for me. That's what it was. Life.
Yeah, and so then coming home, was that? Did you feel like you lived a dream, or you just kind of come home and now I get on back to normal life, or was it difficult to readjust after kind of this amazing experience?
Yeah, they talk about when you do come back that you suffer the post-Olympic blues, and that happens, in my opinion, for a number of reasons. One is that you've been so singularly focused that particular focus is gone. And then two, you've been surrounded in a village where, you know, for example, all those people around you, and you know, it's free McDonald's, it's free chocolate bars, ice cream, so the important things in life. Yeah.
Is it a degree of irony that there's free McDonald's at the Olympics? Like, is that?
It is, and I hate McDonald's, yet I still ate it every single day when I could. I think that was the rebel in me coming out. But then you've got to deal, you ultimately have to deal with the performance. And for me, you know, I had a dream as a 9-year-old kid to go to the Olympics. At about 16, I wanted that. You know, I strongly felt that I had the ability to win a gold medal. And I didn't win a gold medal. I got a silver in my main event. So dealing with that disappointment was very difficult.
Maybe we could just talk about that race now. That was the kind of known as a famous race, still being repeated now. I'm not quite sure how you feel about, you know, seeing Kieran Perkins standing up there after that race. So the men's, so it was the 1996 men's 1500 metres final. You were, the fastest qualifier and probably the favourite after Kieran's form before that had been scratchy at best, scraped into the final.
Mm-hmm.
He went out, swam the race of his life, and many have described it one of the greatest Olympic performances of all time. And you, of course, won the silver. Like, tell us about what happened. You know, what?
Nice to be part of history, I guess. to this day, I have not seen the race in its entirety, and I will not.
Right.
You know, it took me a good 10 years to probably put into perspective what I achieved is something worth being proud of. But I don't know how to put it into words because, you know, at the time I felt that was the worst thing that could ever happen to me. You know, I just and I struggled with that for a long time, and you know, I cried myself to sleep. You know, if not every night, every second night. Just over not winning, and it's interesting. I could relate a lot to Emily Seebohm last week, who came second in the 100 back, and unfortunately, you know, had a meltdown on national television.
Mm.
I could relate to a lot of what she was saying in terms of I've let people down, and so from that aspect. But the race was mine to lose, as you mentioned, and I choked. I couldn't handle the pressure, the expectation. I just wanted to be that kid in my lounge room again. You know, I didn't know how to deal with all that entailed, and I guess you could say I wasn't ready for the dream to become reality.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Kieran's race was amazing. People often ask, could you see him? I was in lane 4, he was in lane 8. I could not see him. I tried valiantly to see him. But I knew before we even started I wasn't gonna win, because I wasn't a great swimmer. I was a good racer. In the lane next to me, things may have been different, but the fact I couldn't see him and the way I just felt in the water, it was just a recipe for disaster on that particular night.
Mm-hmm. Well, so now, you know, it took you 10 years before you kind of began to realise. I mean, I don't think anyone else here has won Olympic silver medals or any medals at all. So how have you managed to recognise that as being an achievement?
I think the fact that I've had different life experience now, and I realise that the results in real life experience came a lot easier than what they have, relatively speaking, to what I achieved in the pool, which was, you know, 15, 20 years of a lot of hard work. So that helped me put it in perspective. Because just, you know, you do little things every now and again. You see a map of the world and go, there's only one person better than you out of this whole thing. And so slowly you start to understand that, you know, you got the rewards from, and more than you ever would have hoped and dreamed from all that hard work. But it just took time. It takes time to heal, I guess. It was very much like a grieving process, which sounds stupid now, but that's what it was like.
No, well, it seems like, it's been, I suppose, one of the media stories of the past week, particularly with the Australian swim team at the 2012 Games. Mm-hmm. People like, you know, Magnussen, you mentioned Emily Seebohm, she, you know, was in tears on national television after winning a silver medal, saying that she let everyone down and so on. So there's a sense of, can you explain or talk a little bit about what the athletes are going through in terms of they feel like they have lost gold, perhaps, or I'm trying to put their performances into kind of some kind of perspective. Do you want to comment on certainly on the on the?
How much time do we have? I think that just when it pertaining to swimming, there's elements we have. We are a victim of our previous success, and with that, I believe that. The history and the tradition and the culture that has developed has slowly eroded away because we don't have enough connection with the past, with the current team today. And so you forget about things. But the expectations have not changed. Mm. And so the swimmers haven't been able to deal with that. And, you know, there's no one more disappointed than they are. Mm. It's just had to play out a lot more publicly than it has previously. So, for them, the real feeling of it all won't hit until they do come back to normality. Mm. A lot of questions are going to be asked, and they are being asked. And right now, the sport is very much imploding. Sad to say, but it's probably something that needed to happen because generally, no matter what it is in we do or in life, is that you need to take those steps back and you need to be able to reassess where you're currently at and make changes to ensure that you can get back on the path. And for swimming, we haven't had to do that before, and now we do, and we've got kids who are probably a lot inside, trying to put on a front that all is okay, but you could see the cracks starting to show even before the event finished.
And we could certainly see some of those cracks becoming very wide as the games progressed. And I suppose when there's questions just come in as well, and I'm touching on this, is there too much emphasis on success perhaps? So when Mitchell Watt won his silver medal in the long jump, the first question the commentator asked him was, you must be disappointed, you won a silver medal. He responded that he wasn't disappointed, but so is it part of our media, which maybe does it reflect society, that we just put too much emphasis on winning?
You're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't type of thing. Like I agree wholeheartedly that, and I commend Mitchell Watt for his comments, because the media do drive elements of it, but in the case of swimming, it doesn't help that some people are very confident in what they are going to deliver and what they are going to achieve, and so it builds obviously I'm talking about James Magnussen, it builds him up, and then it builds everyone else up, so everyone rides with that, and we are very, relatively speaking, small but proud nation. And so when we fail to deliver on what was probably expected, then we start wanting to ask questions why. The thing that really gets my nose out of joint, and I might offend a few people here, is everyone talks about, this is our money, this is taxpayers' money, all the rest of it. And they say it as if, the swimmers or the athletes don't realise that and don't really care. But, you try to put yourself in those shoes, it's you sacrifice a lot. And I don't necessarily feel as though the media do a justice in portraying that, because they just liken success to hundreds of thousands of dollars and this lifestyle, and it's not the case. But ultimately, that going into the sport, you put yourself out there, you expose yourself to it, you've got to deal with it. But other people need to sort of step up and take some responsibility as well.
Well, maybe speaking about maybe disappointment and not achieving things, maybe we'll turn to you, Cam. Demons. You spend a lot of time, obviously, at Melbourne with the players, and this season hasn't quite. Well, I don't know. Maybe
lived up to the expectations.
Lived up to expectations of certain people. How did the players? Because you're the chaplain club.
Can I reflect on what Dan was saying? Definitely. I think, as a nation, we get a lot of identity from our success, and so it's about our identity. And I recall something Kirsty Marshall said last year when we were talking about the weight of expectation on elite athletes, and she said something quite profound. She said, if you're nothing without a gold medal, you're nothing with a gold medal. And in other words, if you're looking to find identity out of winning gold and having success, you're not going to find it. And I think the media, and maybe us, sometimes we're looking because it makes us feel good about ourselves. But I reckon there's a higher call when it comes to elite sport. It's somehow not about us. It's about it's the spirit of the games. It's about competing with the spirit of friendship and trying our hardest. And I think that's actually what we've got to recognise and celebrate. Mm. We've got young kids out there who are giving their hardest. They're absolutely giving their all. We need to celebrate that the spirit of that rather than the outcome of it. Mm. Because it can get really shallow and we sometimes get caught up in all of that.
Is that your reflection? Is that your observation of the culture that we're like in Melbourne as well?
I think in the AFL, you know, the pressure on young men. You're talking about the emotion, the 10 years you went through, and the acuteness of hope and dreaming, and I'm living my dream, and the intensity of that emotion, and when that fails to deliver, it is like a loss. It's like someone dying. And people grieve, and so a lot of these athletes are going to come back from the Olympic Games and they are grieving, and the worst thing you can do to a grieving person is one, say, I know how you feel. The other thing you do is just get over it. No, you've got to allow people to grieve and work through that. And you know what, with a lot of grief, that the notion of finality is a furphy. You just have to learn to manage your grief over time. And what you're saying, Daniel, I think is, it took me 10 years to learn to manage the emotion of the grief. It still hasn't left, but I'm managing it a whole lot better now than... And because with a lot of loss... With a lot of loss, I don't think you can ever answer the why. You can answer the why, you know? Why did that happen? It's unresolvable. Just like if someone dies, why did they die? Can't answer that, but...
So did people say that to you when you came back? They said, oh, I know how you feel, or just get over it, or...
No, I don't recall that ever happening. And one piece of advice I got was, listen, don't be ashamed to get help. You know, go speak to someone. And you're so ingrained as, one, as a male, and two, as an elite athlete, listen, you know, you've got to uphold these sort of fundamentals and have this exterior. And getting help was a sign of weakness, so I wasn't gonna do that. But in retrospect, it would have been the smartest thing I could have done.
Definitely. Yeah. So going back to you, Kaden, and reflecting on Melbourne.
Yep.
And dealing with disappointment.
Yep.
What's your perspective, or how do you comment?
Yeah, I think the key is to have a really good plan of know where you're going, and to work with that. And things might not be working out how other people expect, but if you can measure it and see where you're going, there can be a deep sense of fulfilment. So over the last 6 years at Melbourne, we've had a terrible run, like really. I managed the interchange bench for Melbourne the last 4 or 5 years, and by the end of last year, you're just going, when's it going to turn around? And I'm an optimistic
person. Wanting to come on, was that the...
Yeah, not wanting to come on. Wanting to come off, but yeah, you've got to manage that. You've got to manage it, and internally, the morale of the club has been very good. You talk to most of the players, and even during Dean Bailey's time, internally it was quite buoyant. It was because we can see ourselves progressing. We're measuring the things. We're getting better, and it's just going to take time. And so we're out of the 18 teams in the AFL. Melbourne is 16th with age group, the amount of games played of players. So the expectation is a lot of people expect us to be in finals, but we have a bit, you know, you get a better perspective. And you need to keep your focus on that perspective, I think, is really important. As a chaplain, I'm trying to, because an elite athlete's world is high highs, amazing, the lowest of lows. And, you know, most humans go through this, and an elite athlete within a few years is going through amazing highs, massive lows. As a chaplain, I think, help to bring some balance and perspective along the journey, and not to give up.
Yeah, just had a question come through about the impact of Jim Stein's death at Melbourne, and if you can reflect on that at all.
Jim, remarkable human being, probably the greatest AFL story of all time. You know, this lanky boy from Ireland coming and making it in AFL, and in a lot of ways he was seen as he was a hero in and around the Melbourne Football Club. But as a club, we went through 3 years of his cancer battle. and we were living it every day as a club. So when, and I don't want to say this disrespectfully, but when Jim died, internally it was almost a relief for us, whereas for many other people, the shock of his passing. So, and I say that with utmost respect, but the boys handled the loss. They expressed their grief and emotion. I think that's really important. Mm. They felt the loss of Jim passing. So, a remarkable guy, but he's left a legacy too. And in his wife and Don McLarty, the players, the people that knew him as well. So.
Well, Ken, also, I mean, just touching on it, we're dealing with disappointment and loss and some of all the things you've been talking about. And as we're talking about winning, or maybe not winning, perhaps, as we're talking about now, what would you say? I mean, you're a Christian man, so you're a man of faith.
Yep.
What role do you think faith plays or impacts or helps or in kind of dealing with those kind of things?
Faith, when you speak of the word faith, you often think of religion. But I reckon it's as at home in a sports environment as it is in a church. Stan Owens, the former St Kilda coach, I remember him speaking at a business conference. He spoke about the mantra they had at St Kilda in the late 90s, and he said, we had this team motto, and it said, we need to trust one another, we need to believe in the game plan, and we've got to have faith during times of adversity. And I'm thinking, there you go, trust, believe, faith. That's in the culture. You need to have it in sport in general, but
there's always faith. You have to have faith in your teammates and faith in the coaching staff and so on, I suppose.
One another, that's really important. But you get knocked around in this life, and for me personally, just my life is finding who can I lean on, who can I trust on in the deepest, darkest moments of my life, and how God has been that solid rock for me. And because stuff's going to happen to us, you know, we walk through dark valleys, and one of the things that, you know, experiencing now, Danny, you might be the same, a lot of dark times for people, and the depression and despair, that could be for a range of reasons, but for them to know that they're not alone on that journey, we're not alone, God's with me, he wants the best for me, he wants me to succeed, he wants the best for my life. And often life is a race and a challenge, but he's there with us on that journey. We don't have to despair. We can place our trust in him. So if there's one message as a chaplain I want to say is, hey guys, you're not alone. God loves you and is with you for life. And you can place your trust in him.
And so that, have you found that has been helpful, whatever, for some of the athletes, or the Christian athletes, perhaps?
I just think, you know, there are boys that are really struggling. There's some boys, the weight of expectation, mate, just a weight, plus such a heavy burden, self-expectation on family, expectation of the press, internal expectation, you know, it just crushes individuals, especially when they're 20, and they're just coming to terms with life. Now they've got to deal with all this expectation that can crush them. I talked to some of the Christian athletes about having an audience of one. You've only got an audience of one. It's not mum, dad, it's not you. God's there. You've got a gift as an athlete. You're wonderfully gifted as an athlete. You've only got one person to please, and that's him. And if you do really, really well, he'll be pleased with you. And if you do really, really badly, guess what? He'll be just as pleased with you. He's unconditional and his love and acceptance for us, and it's almost like, almost the weight's off my shoulders. So yeah, a lot of boys want to talk about that, but like Daniel was saying, often there's a bit of a stigma about going to a counsellor, and I think one of the things that works really nicely for us as chaplains, in most of the AFL teams have chaplains now, and through lots of other sports in Australia, is we're not counsellors, but we're there, we're present, we've got time. If players or officials or coaches want to talk about stuff, we're available, and we need to them. So and often they do, but it's often really, if you've got a few moments like that, we'll catch up and have a chat and see how private, discreet.
So Daniel, because I read this morning, I said that press conference after Sally Pearson's win, the bronze medalist and the silver medalist are both Americans and both Christians, and they were both apparently thanking God for all of their
things. And Sally Pearson was asked, you know, well, do you have a faith? What do you think? And she said, well, I'm not particularly religious, but I have a gift, and I want to kind of use that gift to whatever I can. Do you have any comments on maybe on faith sport or faith and what Sally's reaction was to her win and so on?
Well, it definitely has a place in sport. And I think, well, obviously I look at the work that particularly the professional codes do in this country, and a lot of them do offer a chaplain and make those services available. But it's something that's, you know, that I'm not aware of taking place in predominantly Olympic sports. And the irony is that's what is probably needed, is they need to know that they can get that. They can get that support, and there's not going to be a stigma associated with it. And it's a matter of trying to educate the decision makers that, hey, listen, there is a place for faith in sport, mm-hmm. regardless of what your personal stance is. Yeah. But for someone, it is of the utmost importance. For others, it may not be, but they will respect that. Mm-hmm. So what are we going to do to address it? Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot was made on the weekend, the fact that Swimming Australia chose no longer to utilise the services of a sports psychologist. Whether it's a sports psychologist or a chaplain, it meant that there was no opportunity for someone to go and speak to a qualified person about a myriad of reasons. And even if I hadn't been there at the Olympics, it's about building relationships. I remember you telling a story about David Schwartz, who you never had anything to do with, and then when he retired, he didn't know who you are and all the rest of it. But, and I sort of think, okay, well, despite the fact you didn't talk to him or you didn't have a close relationship, he knew that you were there. And but we don't have anything like that. So, you know, you can only surmise, but will it improve performance? You don't know unless it is there, so take the gamble and promote it.
Well, maybe we're just looking at the time. We've got only got a few more minutes to go, but maybe we could step back and have a reflect a bit more on, well, what it is to win. That's the topic we're looking at today. And you mentioned before, Daniel, about that there's sometimes there's more. Winning is not just about crossing the finish line first. There's lots of other things that you need to do. So when you think about winning, what do you think is the most important thing about what it means to win? How would you answer that kind of question? Maybe we'll start with you, Ken.
Yeah, thanks.
So it's a simple question, I know.
Can I say I'm really humbled to be sitting here. I haven't in any shape or form got anywhere where Daniel's got athletically, so I'm really humbled to be able to be here to talk. But just reflecting over the last 15 years, having, you know, some of the key elements, managing, and it's come up now, I heard Dave Neilson, Australia's greatest ever baseball, arguably the greatest baseball player, Australian, Dave Neilson, spoke to our chaplains about 5 years ago on the Gold Coast at the baseball training camp, and he said, elite athletes are professional losers. And he said, not until you're world champion, you've got to learn to lose. And he says, it's not about having a losing attitude, but you lose, 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 and eventually you're at the top and you're the winner. But he says it's as an athlete learning to manage loss and use loss and lose when things don't work out. Use that to your advantage. Learn from it. Allow it to drive you. Allow it to shape you. So don't look at it as a negative. Look at it as something that can really help move you on. So I think that's an important thing. And I said that in AFL as well.
So there's an element of character.
Character. Perhaps, what have we done wrong? What do we need to change about the way we do it? What can we learn from the loss on the weekend about ourselves?
This is a really contentious issue for me because coming from someone who never really won. For the amount of times I raced to the amount of times I stood on the number one podium, it was, you know, I was a professional loser. But I find it very hard to grasp the concept that because I didn't win, I'm a loser. Mm. And so, for me, you know, winning is as simple as being able to lie in bed at night and be proud of what it is you achieve. Yeah. And it doesn't have to have a number or a piece of metal or a financial reward to validate it. It's how it feels inside. So, does that answer?
No, I think that's very helpful. I think because it's about coming back to your character kind of inside that. I was just reflecting even in the last few days. Many would consider that Oscar Pistorius, for example, the South African Blade Runner, would be a winner, even though he didn't even make the final. And Sarah Atta last night, the Saudi Arabian woman, first Saudi Arabian athletics performer, female performer ever. She came last by 45 seconds or something. But many would suggest that she's not necessarily a loser. There's something more to winning. So maybe. As we kind of finalize, so what else should we be considering in terms of winning? What else should we look at? Character.
It transcends gold. You're absolutely right. And Olympics, I always think of that, the 1968 Mexico marathon story. Do you remember that? The greatest last placed ever. It often comes out at Olympic time about Joseph Stephen Akawari in 68 Mexico Olympics. He's last by an hour. The person before him finished the marathon an hour earlier. And he ran into the stadium and the lights were dimly lit. There were hardly any people there. He'd fallen over, his legs were bloodied and bruised, and he collapsed over that final line, and there was only a few people left in the stadium. One of them was a reporter who went up to him and said, "Stephen, was there ever a time you thought about just gracefully bowing out of the race?" And he looked up to this reporter and he said, "Sir, my country did not send me to the Olympics to start the marathon. They sent me to finish the marathon." For him, winning was not just starting something, but it was seeing it through. And for him, that was special. And I love that because that captures something of the spirit of competing. Give your best. And it doesn't matter whether you come first, last, second, third, whatever. Give it your best. That's what that's about. And there's the honour in that, I think.
Because the whole game depends on that. Without that, there's nothing.
There's nothing. That's right.
So that's your contribution as a Christian too, and your calling.
Yes, that's right. And you've got a great gift. So, for me, I think honour God, give it your all. You've got been given a gift, whether in business or sport or in whatever area of your life, to honour God with that. Give it your best. Be passionate about it. Live it.
So we've got probably time. We've got a couple more comments and reflections. We've got a question coming, maybe from someone who perhaps has realised that they're. Chances of athletic success are limited. They said, but how do you deal with it when it's all over, both when you achieve your dreams and when you realise that you won't? When you achieve your dreams and then when you realise that you won't, i.e. that you won't actually achieve your dreams. And perhaps this person's kind of got to the point where they realise that they're not actually going to win that mental event final or something. Any comments on how to deal with finality? It's over.
I guess for that first part of that question, it's never going to be easy. But what I found was you need to surround yourself with good people, and it might not necessarily be people who tell you what you want to hear. It's people who tell you what you need to hear, and not be afraid. I think in my case. My biggest fear was failure, that I had managed to achieve and excel at one particular thing. I was scared that I was going to go out into another phase of my life and not excel and not achieve. And so by surrounding myself with people and not being afraid to ask questions and to take the risks and to fail, I was able to eventually move on. And that's the second part, the realisation that you won't, that happened to me in the latter half of my career. I knew I was never going to be Grant Hackett, Ian Thorpe, Michael Flynn. Those guys were way too good for me. So I just had to readjust what my goals were and make them more realistic. And whilst I never even got on a podium really after that when those guys came around, but I had just as much fun doing it, and that was important.
Okay.
That's right. I think of a lot of the broken dreams of boys who come to the footy club who never actually even get a game. And there's broken, there's broken dreams all along. Just focus on what a wonderful opportunity you've had. Look at the fact that you've been able to train at this level to compete, and the friends that you've made. Look, probably refocus on maybe some of the deeper, lasting aspects of becoming part of a footy club. Yeah, athletes will tend to look at here and now, and it's hard, isn't it, sometimes to look at the overall context, the life context. So that you're blessed, you've got a great family. You are one in millions in Australia. I think there's only about 800 boys who play AFL football. And I can tell you there's tens of thousands who wish they could be doing what you're doing. So learn to delight, learn to be grateful for whatever comes your way in life. I think that's real good.
Maybe the final reflection says we're just about run out of time. We've talked about different ways in which to win. Like sometimes it's a matter of, as Daniel very helpfully suggested, that it's if you consider yourself at the end of the day, you're satisfied with what you've done your best, and so on. But so, what about the ultimateness? What's the is winning the ultimate? What would you suggest would be the ultimate kind of the end of achievement, I suppose? Any comments? Daniel?
Personally, I hope it never happens for me, because I love striving for things, and so I'd hate to feel that I reach the ultimate, because I honestly wouldn't know what way to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The ultimate, making a difference in someone else's life. Might be a bit simplistic, but. You can make for somebody else, but that's endless, isn't it? Like that, it never ends.
God, I sound good. You say making it better for someone else, and I'm
but what? There's great joy in that, isn't there? But you are for it, other. You champion the course for many others, mate. So
great. Well, I think we're just about running out of time. So please, thank you very much, Daniel Kowalski.
Yeah.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.